Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Recent large, devastating fires in New Mexico have swept away livelihoods and threatened and destroyed watersheds and animal habitats. The U.S. Forest Service has undertaken projects to thin forests through prescribed burns and the removal of hazardous fuels, but to what effect? And no matter what we do, can we make our forests fireproof? Do we want to? Joining me today in studio to discuss the issues surrounding forest thinning and fire prevention are Bill Armstrong, U.S. Forest Service Fuel Specialist Program Manager for the Santa Fe National Forest, and Brian Bird, Wild Places Program Director for the Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen.
So, Bill Armstrong, let's start with you. Tell us, please, what it means to be a Fuel Specialist Program Manager with the U.S. Forest Service.
Well, the program management is the dull part, and I won't get into that because that has to do with the bureaucratic aspects. But the a fuel specialist is someone who deals in fuels, and fuels can be defined as material that is accumulated on the forest floor. It can be defined as the vegetation, that sort of material out there that will burn. How we manipulate that so that we achieve our desired outcomes is kind of what the job is all about. When I say desired outcomes, I mean, what sort of objectives do you have? What we need to understand with the forests of the Southwest, and the forests of the West, and perhaps many of the forests, but we'll deal with those in the Southwest. And specifically, I think we should concentrate, because it's the major vegetation component, is the ponderosa pine forests of the Southwest. Those are the ones that cover most of the acreage that we have that we regard as forests. We have spruce fir forests at the higher elevations and mixed conifer at the somewhat lower than the spruce fir. And that's all of those vegetation types are determined by moisture. Okay, you have snows in the upper elevation, you have a different vegetation type. You don't have as much snow at the lower elevation, so you have a different vegetation type there. But the forests of the Southwest, fire has played an integral part in all of these vegetation types.
Now, as a fuel specialist, are you involved both with prescribed burns and burns that happen unintentionally?
Well, yes. Unintentionally, we need to qualify that, okay? Policy allows us to, for a better term, manage natural ignitions.
Okay.
Natural ignitions being lightning. Human-caused ignitions we still have to suppress immediately, because generally there's a crime associated with it, and arson or accidental ignitions and so forth. We have to put those out. Those caused by lightning, we are given the latitude with some of the new policies that are in place of actually allowing those to burn and to accomplish multiple objectives.
All right. Now, how long have you been doing this work?
Well, I guess I've been playing with fire for, oh my God, over 40 years, But as far as this job is concerned with the federal government, the last 15, 20 or so. I don't have a very good memory of these things.
All right. Now, you're with the Santa Fe National Forest, and I believe there are, five national forests here in New Mexico?
I don't know. Brian probably.
Well, I'll get to Brian in a second. But
yeah, close enough.
Okay. And here, our listening area, we're Albuquerque, we're Santa Fe. Give us the rough boundaries of the Santa Fe National Forest, if you would, please.
Well, Santa Fe National Forest extends, from the northern portion up on the Jicarilla Reservation to just below the community of Truchas. On the east side, it extends, over onto the Pecos Las Vegas area over through there. It's about, I think, 1.6 million acres or so of Santa Fe National Forest.
And what's that? What's the southern boundary?
Let's see. Well, the southern boundary, you're going to the Caja del Rio, the edge of the Caja del Rio, and then on the east side, you're going over there towards Glorieta, Roe Mesa, that area. Roughly I-25, except there are lands that extend south of that, but those are the rough boundaries.
And as we sit here in Albuquerque and we look up to the Sandia Mountains, is that the Cibola National Forest?
That's the Cibola National Forest.
All right. And are the forests similar in any ways? You talked about ponderosa pine.
As far as the vegetation goes, yes. As far as the vegetation goes, very similar.
Okay.
Throughout the Southwest. Other aspects, they're they have their peculiarities and their differences.
Okay. Brian Bird, your bio on the Wild Earth Guardians website reveals you've been working for Guardians since 1996. Was it always called Wild Earth Guardians?
No, that's very observant of you. We are celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. So we're in celebration of what was founded 25 years ago as Forest Guardians in Santa Fe. And we have been, you know, we started off a citizens group that saw an old-growth logging proposal on Elk Mountain on the Pecos Las Vegas Ranger District of the Santa Fe National Forest 25 years ago. Sam Hitt was the founder. People will remember his name. And they got together and they successfully challenged the old-growth logging and decided this was a good model. So from a very grassroots, citizens-based organization, we've evolved through the years to an organization of about 27 staff with major offices in Santa Fe, Denver, Missoula, Montana, and even Oregon, California, and Arizona.
And it says on your bio that you've focused on restoration of national forest lands, their critical ecological processes, as well as monitoring, reviewing, and challenging Forest Service proposals and land management plans. Does that mean you've always been on the other side of the Forest Service and even Bill, or are there things upon which you agree with or even work with the Forest Service and with Bill?
Yes, and I often joke that I'd make a great environmental analyst for the U.S. Forest Service because I've spent so many years tearing apart their documents. But, you know, when I first started this job 20 years ago, I was a young biologist out of New Mexico State University, and, you know, I just had a complete passion for the forests of New Mexico, and my job was to look at the proposals of the Forest Service and really question them. And, you know, Wild Earth Guardians acts as a check against some of the exceedances where the federal government might exceed the boundaries of what's good for the resources. And when I first started this job, it was a defensive job. I like to call it reactive. I was reacting to bad proposals around the Southwest. We've come a long way since then. Largely to the work of Wild Earth Guardians, but also to good people within the agency. We've come to a place where we're much more proactive now, and I think the science has helped us greatly in demonstrating what really needs to be done about the conditions of our national forests. So over the years, through a program that Senator Bingaman actually started a little over a decade ago called the Collaborative Forest Restoration Program, we were able to come together with the Forest Service and with what I call practitioners, what used to be called loggers, or people that make a living in the forest. We've all been able to get together and decide kind of on a zone of agreement. Where do the forest need some treatment? Where can we be putting prescribed fire into the forest and sort of resetting it? So, yes, over the last decade, we've really developed a collaborative position with the Forest Service and a lot of the loggers in the state. And it's it's an area of work that doesn't get as much attention as some of the confrontation does.
Yeah. No, let's talk about these forests a bit. I imagine most know we're in a drought. You can see the evidence in our environment and in our forests. But people get away to the forest to hike and to camp, to enjoy their lushness and green, to breathe deeply and to wonder at the tall, bountiful trees. Now, Bill Armstrong, are we enjoying and looking at healthy forests?
Well, we're looking and enjoying it, a forest that has changed dramatically over the last 100 years.
All right. So what shifted to create this dramatic change?
The shift occurred because of historical land uses in the 1800s and subsequent policy changes once the Forest Service came into being in the early 1900s that sought to exclude fire from these forests. Fire had played a role and had burned continually through the forests of the Southwest for thousands and thousands of years since, you know, the retreat of the last ice age 8,000 years ago or so. And beginning in the 1880s, with some of the land use that was occurring at that time and then subsequent institutional policies and so forth that were implemented in the 1900s, fire was excluded, seeing it as an enemy, seeing it as a destructive force. And with the elimination of what ecologists call a keystone process, it's set about changes. And those changes are what we're dealing with today. So from the standpoint of a healthy forest, which is a word that's really value-laden. What I like to say is that we have a forest that is at very high risk, from very rapid and, from a human standpoint, undesirable landscape changes. Fires that we don't like to see, the difference between good fire and bad fire, but fires that we don't want to see, and from, for instance, insect outbreaks that are far beyond what probably happened, you know, prior to 100 years ago. So healthy, it's changed.
All right, Brian, you wanted to add?
Yeah, I want to add, I agree with Bill 100% on what he just said, but I would also add that there's a sort of a mythology right now that you hear often in sort of the politics of this issue that, you know, it's because the agency, the Forest Service, isn't doing enough right now. It's because the Forest Service isn't logging enough. It's not thinning enough. It's not doing its job. And that's absolutely wrong. And I want to add just to what Bill said that, you know, he was right. At the turn of the century, the way we manage these lands changed dramatically. And not only did we suppress all fire, but we overlogged these forests. We took out all the big fire-resistant trees, and we overgrazed them. And people don't often realize that grazing and logging had a big part to do in the conditions we're in now. And it, you know, we could talk for hours about why that is, but the Forest Service has taken some really important actions in recent years to adjust those pressures.
All right. Now, this is something I learned while I was researching. You mentioned the larger trees are the fire-resistant trees. Mm-hmm. That's something good for people to know. Why is that?
Well, I don't want to make it seem like these forests should be homogeneously large trees, because they shouldn't. They should be a variety. They should be very heterogeneous. They should be a variety of dense, smaller trees and then patches of very large trees and openings, for that matter. But the big old ponderosa pine trees, the one we sometimes call yellow bellies, you go up and you smell them and they smell like vanilla. Those are the trees that are completely evolved with fire. And this is another mythology I like to sort of address, is that fire is extremely natural. Bill spoke to this earlier, but, you know, these forests in the South, especially ponderosa pine, are born of fire. They evolved with fire. And so they evolved some things like dropping their lower branches to the ground so that they have a very high canopy base so that the fire can burn through and on the ground to typically take out all the small trees, get carried along by the big grasses that were often grazed away. So yes, the bigger trees are the most fire resilient trees, and they're the ones that last on the landscape the longest.
Now, we have several links on our Colin Show webpage, and I encourage people to take a look at them, because in those links there will be photographs of how forests used to look, how potentially we might want them to look. So I do encourage people to do that. I also want to mention that, as always, you can join in our discussion today. We are talking with Bill Armstrong of the U.S. Forest Service, and we're talking with Brian Bird of Wild Earth Guardians. We're talking about the health of our forests, forest thinning, and fire prevention. You may participate in our discussion by emailing comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Tell us, how can we balance the needs and desires of all, human and animal, for forest use and protection during this time of drought and high fire danger? We'll take a short break now, but when we get back, we'll get to your calls and your comments, and we'll have more discussion with our guests.
Support for KUNM provided by New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, a not-for-profit financial cooperative with member benefits for checking, credit cards, auto loans, and mortgages. Details on member benefits at nmefcu.org.
Outpost 19th Annual Summer Thursday Jazz Nights continues with the jazz soul fusion of vocalist Tracy Whitney and her quartet, plus the flamenco-inspired jazz of Tierra Sonaquet with trumpeter J.Q. Whitcomb and guitarist Joaquin Gallegos, Thursday, June 26th. Then it's Rouse the House Teen Performance Night, Friday, June 27th. Both shows 7:30 p.m. Outpost Performance Space, 210 Yale Southeast. Info at 268-0044 or outpostspace.org. A message from the tax-exempt Outpost Productions.
Welcome back to the KUNM Collins Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo, and today I'm joined by Bill Armstrong from the U.S. Forest Service and Brian Bird from Wild Earth Guardians. We're talking about the health of our forests, forest thinning, fire prevention, and you are certainly welcome to join in our discussion. I do want to let people know that, and I believe we've been announcing this on our station this morning, that the Forest Service will close the Mountain Air and Sandia Ranger districts Monday because of high fire danger. The Albuquerque Journal reports forecasters say it will be hot and dry for at least 10 days, with monsoon weather possibly developing at that time. The Foothills Trail along Tramway in Albuquerque will remain open, along with the Tijeras Pueblo Interpretive Trail and the Road to La Luz Trail. So that's some information for you this morning. Let's go ahead and bring in our first caller. It's Glenn from Hemis Springs, who's been holding on for a while. Good morning, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks for doing this. Very timely. I was at a party last night with some firefighters here in Hemis Springs, and the home of the main firefighter that I know, he said he fought in the Colorado fire last summer, and that on average in this area where those houses were burning, they cost $2.5 million. He said that one house would burn, the next door neighbors wouldn't burn. And I said, what caused that difference? He said one of the main things was ponderosa pines that people had in their yards. When they failed to trim up from the ground, clean up all the dead 8 feet up, their houses would just take off. Zero escaping was something that kept fire away. I did census work up here in this area 4 years ago and noted a lot of wealthy people's homes where trees were not maintained. Right here in the village of Hemis Springs, we have people who have lots of dead trees, and those need to be removed. Our Hemis Thunder newspaper of June 15 has level one fire restrictions begin at Santa Fe National Forest and Valles Caldera National Preserve, and it's noting several areas that people coming up and camping need to be aware of, and I would encourage them to stop at our Highway 4 coffee house and pick up this paper. And the one that I think is most important for those of us living here in Hemis Springs is possessing, discharging, or using any kind of fireworks. Please, Albuquerque and Bernalillo and everybody else who comes this way, keep your fireworks away. We used to have a fire display here, and I don't know if it's going to happen this year if we get rains beforehand, but fireworks and people who throw out cigarettes, that really is not what we need. Thanks for this discussion, and I hope people pay attention.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning, Glenn. You wanted to comment?
Well, Glenn brings up a really important issue that we're grappling with at the policy level across the country, and that's we spend literally billions a year of taxpayer money suppressing fires and protecting homes, protecting really quite expensive homes in some cases, but all homes. And we really have to grapple with that issue because it's really an issue of personal responsibility. Because when you build a home in a fire-prone forest, I call it a fire plain. We realized this danger with floodplains many, many years ago. And now we're starting to grapple with the fire plain in the same way. And people that live in these forests need to take responsibility, both with what Glenn mentioned, you know, taking care of their own properties, but insuring their properties. And I think counties and states need to develop ordinances, and Colorado is starting to do this, around, you know, how do we build in these areas, and do we build in these extremely flammable areas? I'll make one note here, one fact. Of 11 western states, New Mexico is the 8th, and Arizona is the 10th largest area of undeveloped forested private land bordering fire-prone forests. We have 600 square miles of undeveloped private forest lands adjacent to these fire-prone lands. We call that the wildland-urban interface. There's a huge potential to continue developing in that area. And if we're going to do that, we need to have ordinances, and people need to take private responsibility and not expect taxpayers to come forward with billions of dollars and frankly, firefighters' lives. You know, we lost a lot of firefighters last year in one single fire. Mm. And, you know, every time this happens, we think we learn a lesson. But the fact is, we still put these poor guys and gals in harm's way to protect our properties. And I think it's a really critical issue.
Bill, what's your response to what Glenn had to say?
Well, I mean, he's living. He's certainly living in a situation where, you know, inevitably they will probably see a fire up there. I mean, fire is an inevitability within these forests. Every year we have hot, dry, windy weather. We're surrounded by volatile vegetation. And sources of ignition are infinite. You know, I'm looking at two of them here at the table, you know, but I'm also including the lightning that occurs. And lightning is an ever-present phenomenon here in the Southwest. So, you know, people need to be aware that when they build in these forests, they can live here, but there are certain ways to build and there are certain ways to do things in preparation for the inevitable fire. What I would like to see is neighborhoods and communities such that have taken the precautions and have done what they need to do to their structures. People get fascinated with the vegetation, where many times it's the structure itself that is much more flammable than the vegetation. But to do things to their structures and to their environments, so when these fires come, the fires burn through the communities, turns the ground black, perhaps scorches some trees, and after the fire has passed, people return to those communities relatively unscathed. Because trying to keep fire out it doesn't work. It's many times it's futile. We would like to think that local fire departments can get a handle on when these fires come into communities, for instance, and that we do work around structures, cut thin, whatever. But many times the structures themselves are what is the most flammable, and a single ember landing in an eave that has pine needles in it will catch the house on fire. Most structural fire departments don't have the capability of fighting more than one structural fire at a time. And so when you have a wildfire coming to a community where you might have hundreds, the situation is futile. It's like fighting a hurricane. And so prevention is really the only, I won't say it's surefire, but it's the only thing that's going to increase the probability that your structure, your house, and your landscape will survive.
Now, and I don't know if you have direct contact with this, but I imagine people can look to the Forest Service and other agencies for information about how to protect their structures.
Oh, there's all kinds of information out there from the state, from local fire departments, or on the web. An individual by the name of Jack Cohn has invaluable research that anyone could pull up and read. It's most measures that need to be taken around structures are very easy. It's basically cleaning up, picking stuff up, and making sure that stuff isn't against the house. A few relatively inexpensive measures to xeriscape. It's not something that requires a lot of effort.
Yeah, and just Google FireWise on Google FireWise. There's a whole effort around the country to certify communities as FireWise.
FireWise.org,
yeah.
I think, is that.
And
that
so
website?
People need to go to that and get your community certified.
All right, let's bring up an email comment because we can talk about this. So here's from Dio or Dio, and I apologize for uncertainty about pronunciation, but Dio says, burning is one of the worst ways to manage overly dense forests. He likes the National Forest Service cutting trees and then public harvest. This is a huge topic. It's about time for us to go ahead and dig into it because this is where we might have differences of opinion about how to handle things. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, you know, in a perfect world, you know, that would be great. But we're dealing with landscapes that are millions of acres, and to go out there and mechanically thin all of these acres, that's not going to happen.
So it's a matter of efficiency in many ways.
Yeah, it's a matter of scale and efficiency, and the tools that we have for doing the best job that we can. Prescribed fire is the only tool that we have that we can really impact the number of acres that we have out there. There's a lot of challenges with it, and there's a lot of risks associated with it. But, you know, the choice is between good fire and bad fire. Good fire prevents bad fire. Good fire meaning those that we can burn and that we can light under conditions that we can control. In other words, the weather. We can do it in such a pattern and to mitigate intensities. We can figure out where it's going to stop. But the only tool that we have to prevent bad fire is good fire.
Now, I was reading a Santa Fe Reporter article, I believe, from December, and there was specific talk about the Santa Fe watershed, which is so close to the city. And maybe it was even you who was speaking with the reporter about how steep those slopes are that would make mechanical thinning impossible. But there was also talk about helicoptering in fire, I believe. Is that a possibility?
Well, the expense associated with helicopters is pretty astronomical. And as far as mechanical thinning, if you're talking about crews, people on foot, there's not too many places given enough money that people won't go on foot. We can thin very steep slopes.
Mm.
But that's, you know, this is each situation, it depends. In some places, we cannot burn without doing some mechanical preparation beforehand. The risks are too great. Next to communities, within houses, perhaps within critical watersheds. No one is going to take the risk. No one, meaning a practitioner, is not going to take the risk of burning in those areas without some sort of mechanical prior to burning to reduce those fuels. But we have vast areas of the forest where fire is and will have to be the principal tool.
Now, Brian, is Wild Earth Guardians willing to embrace the "it depends" aspect of things?
Well,
some it depends. Sometimes fire is best. Sometimes mechanical thinning.
As I used to sort of look askance at Mr. Armstrong here, I think we probably agree on more things than most people do at this point. But, you know, Dio talked about thinning, and I think that Bill hit it on the head. There are trade-offs associated with all of this, and you opened the hour talking about trade-offs, and it's true. And what Wild Earth Guardians does is attempts to keep, you know, a check on on the thinning and on the cutting and on the, some of the things that could cause damage to our wild watersheds and our wildlife. And it's important to understand that we don't have a ton of money to go out there and thin and burn, and so we have to be very strategic about these activities, because it's all taxpayer money we're using to do this. And so we need to, and I think the Forest Service is taking on this effort and doing a good job about starting to design projects where we put thinning on the ground in very specific places where we know it will have the most benefit as far as preventing fire from moving into a watershed or preventing fire from moving into a community, and then using fire across a landscape where we can. But there are extremely important trade-offs when you go in and do thinning, whether it's hand crews or especially with heavy equipment, because that's typically how we do thinning. You're going to have impacts on soil. You're going to have impacts on water quality, fish. You're going to have impacts on some of the animals that we love, like, you know, the owls and the goshawks and other animals like that. You really have to think about those trade-offs and be very, very cautious. And that's where Guardians comes in and tries to keep the caution part of the equation.
All right, let's get back to our callers. We've got a lot of people who want to join in this discussion. Let's get Todd from Albuquerque in with us. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I was curious. I was told about 100 plus years ago, the Spanish used to run large herds of sheep from Santa Fe to Farmington, herds of up to 3,000. And they'd also do prescribed burns in the valleys in the high mountains to keep them free of the forest. So next year they come through, they'd have stuff to eat. It sounded a lot like the holistic herd management work done by Alan Savory. And just curious if you could comment on the use of large animal, you know, large herds moving rapidly in conjunction with fire.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Todd. Bill, you want to comment on Todd's call?
Well, I'm not a range specialist, so I'm familiar with Savory's techniques, but I can't speak upon them. What I can speak upon, however, is that the beginnings of fire exclusion occurred principally because of the grazing that occurred in the 1880s. The forest that we had prior to the 18, and I'm talking about a broad landscape. These changes occurred. The changes I'm going to be talking about occurred on a local level, probably prior to that. But you know, prior to 1880, the forests were much more open. They were because they were so open, you had grasses, you had herbaceous vegetation, and so forth that grew, you know, under the trees. When you have a closed canopy, you don't have that. You had these open forests where fire burned through the grasses with a minimal amount of intensity and probably killed very few of the overstory trees, thinned out the understory, consumed fuels, recycled nutrients, what we would like to think of as, quote-unquote, good fire. In the 1880s, with the arrival of the Transcontinental Railroad, suddenly large-scale, unregulated at the time, livestock grazing became economically viable. You could put your cow on a boxcar and send it back east and make money on it. It used to be you had to walk the poor thing, and there wasn't much left of your cow by the time you got back there. So the, you know, the introduction in about 1886 of huge numbers of sheep, cows, horses, burros, and all of the accoutrements that go along with grazing, you know, fell upon the state, and they ate all the grass. Not only did they eat the grass, but cows make trails, and which are de facto fire lines, fire breaks. Mm. They changed the landscape, and the fire stopped. We can see in the records that have been taken in the in very, very good fire histories that we have that have been collected by the University of Arizona, looking at fire rings and fire scars and so forth. The 1886 fires stopped, and with that cessation of fire, then you had a couple of things that started to occur. One is that when trees regenerate, it used to be that fires would burn through and thin those little seedlings out. There was no thinning mechanism. So when seedlings established, they continued to grow. In these forests of the Southwest, you have the decomposition rate doesn't keep up with the accumulation rate. It's too damn dry. It's, you know, stuff falls and it stays there. You know, we can find logs and stumps that date to the early 1800s, for heaven's sakes, on these mountains. And so the recycling mechanism of fire was disturbed. And so you had started to begin to have these huge fuel accumulations that began to build up. And so the grazing of the 1880s set the stage, and that's when the changes began. So, you know, the role of sheep herders and the role of people on the landscape, wherever you've had pastoral societies or aboriginal societies, they have used fire. But in terms of the effects of grazing, well, I think on the whole, they were probably the major contributor to the cessation of fire.
Interesting. Yeah, briefly?
Yeah, just before you take your next caller, I think that Bill was very polite about it, and I'll just be more succinct. Livestock grazing is part of the problem, not the solution on our national forests.
All right. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Whitney from Albuquerque. Good morning, Whitney.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
This is my first time calling in. I wanted to thank you for your show. But one of the things I wanted to ask, I've been you know, grew up here in New Mexico, went camping a lot with the Boy Scouts, worked at the scout camp up near Chimayo, and I've seen, you know, a lot of the effects of fire. Also, when I was in high school, the really destructive Cerro Grande fire up near Los Alamos took place, and one of the things I'm wondering about is why the Forest Service isn't using these large natural fires as an opportunity to start going in and reestablishing a natural pattern of fire. So, for example, like Cerro Grande fire, or I lived in Arizona for a while, and the Rodeo Tedesco fire was very huge and destructive, and really that seems to me like a really good opportunity to help restart that natural pattern. So I just wanted to get some comments about that and what your opinions of that are.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning, Whitney. And Brian?
Sure. You know, one thing that Whitney said that is a bit of a misnomer is that all fire, or what he mentioned, he described these fires as extremely destructive, as you did on the intro to the show. And we have to understand that fire, again, is such a natural part of these ecosystems. It's absolutely necessary. And in fact, burned forest habitat, and not when it's completely catastrophic, but when it's, you know, burned, is actually good habitat for many species that are rare on the landscape now. And it creates a kind of habitat that's actually rare on the landscape. And we as humans tend to anthropomorphize the whole thing and say, oh, goodness, when the fire comes through, it's destroyed everything and it's gone. And, you know, yes, there were parts of Cerro Grande and parts of Las Conchas fire that were extremely destructive, and we do not want to see those types of fires on the landscape. But generally, across the Southwest, we can say that even Rodeo Tedesco, I would argue, burned pretty normally. And when I say normally, I mean about 25%
of the fire area burned at high intensity. And that's a Forest Service terminology for how hot and how much vegetation gets burned away. So you have high intensity, moderate intensity, low intensity, and unburned within these fire perimeters. So when we see a giant fire like Las Conchas and we say, oh my God, the whole thing was destroyed. In fact, it wasn't. There were parts of it, again, that we don't want to see. But for the most part, fire did its job. And I'd also just mention that the Forest Service is out there reestablishing fire regimes. And that is the objective here, is to do some thinning, do a lot of burning, and allow natural fire to do its job so that we can get these natural fire regimes back in the system. And one more last thing. In order to do that, we need to make people in these communities and in the Southwest comfortable with fire. And that's a big challenge because
with the smoke.
Well, smoke is a big issue. People don't want to see smoke. But I would argue that there was probably a time prior to European settlement when summers were smoky across the West. That was just the way it was. And I'm not saying that we want that all the time. But if the Forest Service does controlled burning in the way that it intends to, it can control smoke to a certain degree. When we have wild, catastrophic fire, the smoke is completely uncontrolled and will go in any direction it chooses. So the Forest Service is generally, and the state, are doing good jobs at reintroducing fire and trying to burn under the right conditions when they can control smoke.
We're talking today about forest thinning, the health of our forests, and fire prevention. I'm joined today by Brian Bird. He's the Wild Places Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians, and by Bill Armstrong, U.S. Forest Service Fuel Specialist for the Santa Fe National Forest. If you would like to join in our discussion, you may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org or post comments on the Call-In Show webpage. You may call our local number 277-5866 or our toll-free number 1-877-899-5866 with questions and comments. We'll be back in a moment with more discussion with our guests and with you.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, conscientious objection to military service in the era of the U.S. all-volunteer military
is still, in the end, a very altruistic act that most of these folks are making. And so they're coming in here to do good. And then when they see the dehumanization that must take place in order for war and war making to be possible, it changes something in them.
That's Peace Talks Radio this Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.
What do you do when critters build a nest in that old truck you've been meaning to fix up one of these days, and then you discover they've chewed the seat cushions to line the nest? The wisest thing to do, Grasshopper, is to transform that damaged truck into perfectly formed radio. The method is simple and has been used by many wise ones over the years. Just call 888-KUNM-CAR, and a tow truck appears and hauls it away. Remember, always, 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about the health of our forest thinning, and fire prevention. I want to go ahead and read an email question from Sherilyn Taharis, who says, the Forest Service has thinned along Highway 14, but left the trees and brush on the ground. Is that dangerous, Bill?
Well, it depends. You know, I'm not that familiar with a specific project, but I would assume that there's going to be measures taken to reduce that, either through prescribed fire or some other mechanism. I can't see us doing that sort of work, thinning and so forth, and creating what we call a slash hazard, which is the residue after thinning, without some measure being taken to eliminate or reduce that. But not knowing that specific project, I don't know what measures are in place, but in the aftermath, I would feel pretty comfortable saying, you know, within the next year or so, yeah, something will be done to address that.
Is there somewhere can Cheryl call to ask questions? Just local Forest Service.
I would think whatever district that's on, they should have. Okay. They should know what they're going to do with it.
All right. So Cheryl, go ahead and make your call, and you can find out specifically about that. Let's bring our next caller in. It's David from Santa Fe. Good morning, David.
I can answer Cheryl's question, and know the slash piles are far less dangerous than the standing trees that were cut down to make those piles. The danger is when you have evenly spaced fuel so the fire can go through and burn from tree to tree to tree in a rapid succession. When the fuel is piled, the one pile can't start the next pile. Also, when they're piled like that, they can't get the massive oxygen that standing trees can get. So no, those piles are not dangerous. What I called about, I'm glad to hear more and more guests and callers saying what I've been saying for years, and that's that the mismanagement of the forest by the Forest Service for decades and centuries now is the problem, and they scapegoat the public by blaming the public for starting forest fires and by locking the public out of the forest like the Sandia and Cibola just did. They just closed the forest now to the public use, and that's the wrong thing to do. It's not preventing fires anyway, because every day when there's thunderstorms, thousands and thousands of thunderbolts, lightning bolts hit the ground, and many, many of them start little fires, akin to what somebody throwing a cigarette out the window might do. And so by locking the people out of the forest, you're just scapegoating them and making it so that people can't make plans during the summer to use the forest because they don't know when the forest is going to be closed, other than with a week's notice, and then they don't know when it's going to reopen because they don't know when the rains are going to come. And so you just need to cut to the chase and let burn what's going to burn, use your resources to protect property owners while it's burning, and just get it over with. Otherwise, you're just perpetuating the problem into forever. You need to cut to the chase and just let it go back to the way nature intended it to be.
All right, David, thanks so much for your call this morning. And we've actually heard from both of you about collaboration now with the Forest Service rather than assigning blame, working together. Who would like to comment on this? Bill, you want to go ahead?
Well, there's a number. The gentleman stated a number of different statements here. As far as closing the forest is concerned, given when we get to a certain situation like this, given the community's economic dependence upon these forests, given the people pressures and so forth, it's prudent to try to minimize the potential for sources of ignition out there when conditions get to an extreme. Granted, we have lightning. That's something that we can't control. Many times that lightning, however, occurs, towards the end of the dry period, and rains follow soon afterwards. In April, May, or into June, we may be many, many weeks away from any sort of predictable moisture. And so a fire at that time many times will burn with results that we really don't want to see. And so it's a precautionary measure, and it's politically charged. But we are a public agency, and we are a political agency. And when you have people who are fearful of the consequences of wildfire that are started by people, which, by the way, is a crime. It's arson, or, they're certainly liable for the damages, whoever lights a fire, whether it be accidental or intentional. It's a prudent measure, and it's a decision that's not taken lightly. I'm trying to think of what the other issue was.
We could stop with that one. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I would just tend to agree with most of what David actually said from Santa Fe. I would also point out an interesting statistic, and that's that 1% of fires result in the majority of acres burned. And the reason I say that is because the most fires are either suppressed or put out before they're about 5 acres by the agency. And it's really the fires that happen on the edge of the fire season, outside the normal monsoon season, that cause the most damage. If you look at Las Conchas, you look at Cerro Grande, you look at all these big, gigantic fires that did do some damage, they happened early in the summer or even the spring, sometimes in May, and they were human started. They were ignited by power lines, campfires, human ignitions. And so, there is some prudency to closing forests during these extreme conditions, but it does affect our communities because many people that live and work on the national forests, they make a living by outfitting, by taking people up into these forests, by selling sodas and candies at the gas station at the entrance to the forest. Those businesses are severely impacted. So it can only be done during really the most necessary times. I do want to speak to collaboration, though, because Guardians has shifted a bit in its strategies in recent years, you know, where we fought everything for so many years, and we will still fight the really bad projects that are going to have devastating effects on water and wildlife. But I will say we have begun to collaborate with the foresters in places like the Southwest Hamas Mountains, where they have the first ever second collaborative forest landscape restoration project, which is a newly funded program that was also written by Senator Bingaman that allows forests to propose in collaboration a very large landscape project and then receive up to $4 million a year for 10 years to implement various restorative projects like thinning, road decommissioning, taking old roads out, putting beavers back into the system, restoring riparian vegetation, lots of different activities. So we are collaborating in that project in an attempt to make sure the Forest Service does all those good things I just mentioned and doesn't do anything undue that we don't agree with. It's a challenging new model, I will say that, because it's bringing in activists like myself. It's bringing in practitioners, loggers. The New Mexico Forest Industry Association is involved. The Nature Conservancy is involved. The Forest Service is involved. The tribes are involved. Jemez Pueblo is involved. So everybody wants something out of this. And it's a very challenging way to work. And I think the biggest challenge is culturally for the Forest Service, because they tend to have operated for so many years in a vacuum. And now suddenly they've got all these public at the table telling them what to do. And it's a challenge because they've operated so sort of autonomously for so long. This is their challenge.
That sounds like a beneficial challenge. Now, we do have a link on our webpage to a program. You pointed me toward it, Earth on Fire, premiered on Australian television early this June. And, Bill, you are certainly in there. And there are some claims made about conifers disappearing. And I believe our next caller, Michael, who is a climatologist, wants to address that topic. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Well, I attended a talk at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science this spring. And, I don't remember the name of the researcher, but he's one of the co-authors of some recent studies by Seeger and Cook, a number of other authors. And I believe those papers are about a shift in the timing of the peak spring runoff and another antipodal parameter in the fall. In any event, this researcher claimed that all of the conifers in New Mexico would disappear by 2040, given greenhouse gas emission scenarios. And I find that hard to believe, and I was wondering if either of you had any opinions about it.
All right, and thanks so much for your call. And I believe in Earth on Fire it said 2050, and it was a researcher at LANL. So, Bill, you want to address that? Is that accurate? Or possible, I guess?
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the research and the individual that was conducting that. I don't know. It's the future. It's hard to envision conifers completely disappearing. It's not hard to envision them going upslope, of retreating upslope into the higher elevations. You know, the ebb and flow over the eons with climate change that has occurred in the past. You know, as things get warmer, species move uphill where moisture regimes still with snow and so forth, are still present. I mean, the Southwest is full of sky islands that are a vestige of the last ice age, where, you know, trees have moved from the lower elevations into the higher elevations. For them to completely disappear, I don't know. I mean, again, that's based upon models and predictions, and in my experience, all models are wrong. They inform. I certainly hope that's not the case. I'm not going to say if it is or it isn't, because, again, it's something that I don't think we can really, really portend. But we're certainly going to be looking at some changes, I think, with the increase in temperatures that have already occurred and that seem to be occurring, one being the spring runoff occurring much earlier. That's certainly documented, and it seems to be progressing, accordingly. But as far as the future goes, I don't know.
All right, let's bring in perhaps our last caller of today. It's Dorothy from Taharis. Good morning, and you have a comment or a question briefly for us, Dorothy.
A couple of things. One, lots of praise for the Sandia Ranger District. We work with the foresters there, and they are a fabulous team, and I can't say enough good things about them. But I want to go back to a point Brian made about policies. On the East Coast, where they've had all this flooding with the hurricanes, people are now required to raise their houses up and build them differently or not build in certain areas or have dunes. I wonder if we're making any progress on policies for landowners that live on the wildland interface.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Brian.
Yeah, we are. I mean, Colorado, especially after the last awful Black Forest fire last year that killed people and burned million-dollar homes, Colorado has taken it very, very seriously and are starting to consider fees for building in the interface that would allow for, you know, to pay for firefighting and other things. But yeah, New Mexico is getting there slowly. We have some good programs. The state has some great programs on their watershed health pages and their FireWise pages. So look at the state forestry website for more on that. And I don't totally, it's possible that we could lose all our forests to climate change. It's certainly possible. But I think we would kick ourselves and if we didn't do something. And I think that's where we need to try to reintroduce the processes that have regulated these forests for eons, and that's really fire, and to some degree it's insects. So we always think of insects as awful, but insects have a job, and I just want to make sure we understand we cannot reset these forests through like a thinning program or anything like that. We have to get the process back into this forest, and that process is really fire.
But doesn't thinning help the process to some degree?
It can in places, and we have to be very strategic about that, again, about how we spend our money and where we spend our money.
Bill, talking about money, I wanted to segue into this as a sort of a last topic. Does the Forest Service have enough money for this strategic remediation of the forest, or is it going mostly to firefighting?
No, it's going mostly to firefighting. We're looking at the Southwest Hemis, for instance, the project that Mr. Byrd here spoke briefly about. We're getting $4 million a year, you know, hopefully over a period of 10 years. Santa Fe currently gets a little over $1 million for fuels work. On the Las Conchas fire, we spent about $70 million, you know, in a matter of weeks in suppression. There needs to be, and I'm not sure at what level that occurs, if it's congressional or beyond, it needs to be a shift in those funds, away from suppression into what I call good fire, into prescribed fire, with accompanying thinning where it needs to be done. But at the scale that the problem exists, and we're not just talking about New Mexico, but, you know, throughout the Intermountain West, No, it isn't. The efforts on the part of treating those acres is nowhere near sufficient.
And Brian, just as a closing, you want to comment briefly on that? I saw you shaking
your head. I agree 100% with what Bill just said. And Congress is actually considering a bill right now that would shift money into a special fund, just like we deal with flooding, it would deal with wildfire.
And so I encourage people to look at our website today. We have a number of links up to organizations, to the Forest Service. If you have questions, you can certainly contact the Forest Service. They have public affairs departments. I do encourage people to watch Earth on Fire. Also, we have a link on the website to that. I want to thank our guest today, Bill Armstrong, U.S. Forest Service Fuel Specialist for the Santa Fe National Forest, and Brian Byrd, Wild Places Program Director for the nonprofit Wild Earth Guardians, for making themselves available to our listeners. Thank you. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks
to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Apologies to anyone we were unable to speak with. Thanks to our engineer, Roman Garcia, and our assistant producer, Kaveh Movahed. Michael Hess has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.